She Who Must Be Loved is a documentary that tells the epic life story of Freda Glynn, who co-founded KARMA, the Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association, and Impaja TV. Frida is a pioneer of Indigenous media, and two of her children, Warwick Thornton and Erica Glynn, as well as a couple of her grandchildren, Dylan River and Tanith Glynn Maloney, have followed in her footsteps as filmmakers. Another granddaughter, Rona Glynn McDonald, is working on a series of dreaming stories in Central Australia and a digital keeping place called Common Ground. She was one of our guests on Word Up speaking Kadich. But as you'll see in the first few scenes in this documentary, Frida Glynn is not particularly interested in talking about herself. Instead, she insists the story should focus on her pursuit of the truth about her grandmother's death in a massacre. Erica Glynn spoke to Rudy Bremer about directing a director and being part of a film dynasty.
See, I don't normally sit here and talk to myself.
Talking to us.
Yeah, I know, but you're supposed to be having my morning tea.
So my name's Erica Glynn. I'm a filmmaker originally from Central Australia, now living in Sydney. And I've just made a documentary about my mother called She Who Must Be Loved.
What do? You just normally just sit there, have your cup of tea and do your...
And do my thing, and then yeah. I get up and do things.
Yeah, well, just know. Do that, do your thing.
I mean, you can't follow me around all day.
Yes.
It's going to be 2 minutes, eventually.
You're not the boss, are you? It'll only be 2 minutes,
and no, it won't be any more than 3.
Erica, it has obeyed crossed out. Can you tell me a little bit about why obeyed was there and also why it's kind of not?
So my mother was involved in establishing the first Aboriginal media organisation in the country in Central Australia called KARMA, the Central Australian Aboriginal Media Association. And in the early 80s, when she was looking for more airtime and looking for better access to the community radio station in town, which was run by a bunch of right-wing kind of godfathers in our community in Alice Springs, she would take them on, and they didn't like being taken on. They would refer to her in the local newspaper as She Who Must Be Obeyed. And of course, our film didn't land that way. You'll see that Mum wasn't that interested in talking about the nitty-gritty details of her working life at KARMA and Impaja. She was more interested in talking about our family life. And so the She Who Must Be Obeyed title kind of didn't work in that respect, although there were reasons to keep it. And really we felt like, well, actually she's just a woman who needs to be loved. And so the Obeyed got crossed out but kept there, and Love took over.
It's actually a really fantastic moment when you do go to ask her about those early days of KARMA and Impaja, and I think she's incredibly blunt. I think the wording was something to the effect of, everyone asks me about that, that's boring.
Yep, that's exactly what happened, and that's exactly how she feels. You know, she spent 10, 11 years working at KARMA, and it made a significant contribution to the nation and the way it thinks about Aboriginal people. But she only sees it as a small portion of her life, a small portion of her working life, and a small portion of her family life. And while we all like to think it had a big impact, she's like, oh, well, whatever. I know it did, but I've got, you know, more significant things to do, more important things to do, which is like sit around and meditate and veggie garden, you know?
Well, when you were thinking about doing a documentary about your mother, about Frida, why did you want to do it?
I wanted to make the film. I mean, a lot of people have wanted to make this film with Mum, people in our family and people outside of our family. And she's always sort of brushed them off. She's pretty expert at doing that. But for me, I wanted to do it because I think that what she achieved at KARMA, obviously, was pretty special. It drew attention to Aboriginal people needing to talk about themselves, needing to entertain themselves, needing to have issues explained to them, like all of that stuff that's sort of been forgotten by our nation about Aboriginal people not speaking English as a first language, needing to be communicated to in their own language, all of that really sort of critical stuff, which we all take as as ordinary today, well, at that time it had to be fought to. So that was a very special contribution, and that was worth talking about from my point of view. She obviously didn't think it was worth talking about. I mean, another really amazing reason to tell this, her story in particular, is that she, people like her and David Gulpilil, they were black faces that kind of represented our nation. They helped make the nation look good. They helped make the nation go, yeah, look what we do for black fellas. You know, they were amongst the crowd of people that did that. And like, Mum did that on the smell of an oily rag. She is by no means a wealthy woman, and she never earned huge amounts of money. And today she sort of lives in poverty, you know. And when I look at that and I go, what extraordinary contributions they made, or Mum made, and look what she's got to show for it, I get angry about that. I get a little bit pissed off about that. But that's the truth of it. And I wish it was otherwise, but it's not. That's what she's got. And she's, you know, like, life could be better for her. I feel like that. She probably doesn't, but I do. But beyond that, even beyond that, I think she's of a generation of Aboriginal people who've been through extraordinary change in the country. How she started, you know, as a child, to where things ended up for her, and they certainly aren't over now, but the change she lived through, you know, like, everyone thinks of a lot of stuff happening long time ago in our country, but they haven't. It was very recent, and there's still people alive today who've been through these mad changes, you know, black fellas who've been through so much cultural change.
I think, yeah, there's this sort of strange way that people outside of our own communities interact with our history, where even sort of things that are quite recent are like, but just forget about that. Like, that's also so long ago that it's not of interest.
Yeah, it's true. And that's why Mum's story was important, you know, because she, like many other black fellas, it's not in the deep past. It's in the recent past, a lot of this stuff, a lot of heartache, actually. I mean, I know she'd say, and good stuff, and that's true too, but actually, it's a lot of heartache. Every sort of all the big points around colonising of this nation has happened in her lifetime, or directly affected her. Massacres, stolen generations, institutionalisation, white men taking advantage of black women, slavery, all of that stuff has directly affected my mother. Self-determination, creating industry for ourselves as black fellas, getting jobs, all of that has happened in my mother's lifetime.
My grandmother was a cottage woman, but my mother would never ever talk about her. See, my mother was in a situation where her mother was shot in one of the massacres. She told me on the east side, meaning the highway, east side of the highway, because at the same time the Coniston massacres was going on. The thing about Mum is that she wouldn't go back to her country ever. Even when I got a car and we wanted to, we used to go camping, we all went south or over to the west, we never went north. And she wouldn't go driving past the 16 mile, except if she was in a bus and went straight through. She just did not want to go back to that country north of Alice Springs.
So the massacre story is something that me and all my siblings have grown up knowing about. I've heard it. I've heard that story hundreds of times in my life. My mother's told us. Her mother mentioned it to her. And as my mother's got older, it's become more and more important for her to investigate that more and find out more about it. And so that becomes part of the documentary, her pursuit of this story of the massacre. And as part of that pursuit, we find some records that throw the family story on its head, like it turns things upside down. And for me personally, I never not believed my grandmother's story. I mean, it so dictated our lives. It was why we were living in Alice Springs, why she chose to live in Alice Springs, why she chose to move, partly to move from that country, you know. So I've never doubted it, but there's a moment where it does throw up doubt, you know, and we just have to, I don't know.
Because it's something that a lot of us have encountered, where your family's history and your family's sort of, I guess, the way that your family tells their own stories doesn't always match up to the records. And there's like, I feel that a lot of us are always going to have that tension, and knowing at what point to kind of stop looking at the records.
Yeah, so, you know, the film ultimately becomes about the white version of events and our family's version of events and what we know to be true and the way the records twist and subvert things, you know. And, you know, how dissatisfying that is for Mum, you know, like she truly, truly hoped that there would be something, there would be some kind of documented record. And it's a struggle for her to not get that, you know. It's sad for her.
Mm. I mean, to a certain degree, the film becomes the record.
Absolutely. Absolutely, the film becomes the record. And that's why it's important for us as storytellers, and it doesn't have to be just film, it's important for us as Aboriginal folk to go out and record this stuff, because it doesn't take long before it's gone. And, you know, like, I'm not that old, but I've been doing this stuff long enough to know that stuff disappears very quickly, and it's sort of beholden on us. It's a duty for all of us people who can push record on our mobile phones to record this stuff from our old people, or us who can, you know, use a computer to write stuff down, to sit there with our people, sit there with our families and listen to the stories and document them, because that's when they become records.
I wanted to ask about your family, because you've got a fair number of storytellers within your family.
So, I mean, our family's sort of relatively well known for being filmmakers. There are four of us who, you know, make a living out of telling stories on screen. And, you know, as you probably all know, Warwick's a bit famous, you know.
Just a bit.
But, you know, like, there's much more than four of us in our family. And, you know, I've got four children, and each and every one of them, and some still do, have worked on the front line of youth care. And that's really tough, hard, amazing, takes very special qualities to be able to do it, and very necessary and needed work. And yeah, I do what I do, but what they do is extraordinary, and I love them for it. And like, we're just not all filmmakers. Not everyone in our family is filmmakers.
It's nice to acknowledge, yeah, sort of the actual majority of the family. I mean, when it comes to because the four of you that are filmmakers are quite distinct, like, styles and skill sets. And when it comes to working on a film about your own family, how do you make sure that it's not too many cooks?
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Look, you know, to their great credit, everybody just left me to it. You know, like, nobody interfered. It would have been a completely different film if Warwick would have done it. It would have been a completely different film if Dylan would have done it, you know, because we've all got our own perspective. And yeah, like I say, to the great credit of my family, they didn't interfere. They just allowed it to happen the way I wanted it to happen, and they trusted that I would get it out, you know, the way that I needed to get it out. They weren't going to interfere, and they did it, and I love them for it.
One person who did have very firm ideas was Frida herself. How do you direct a director?
Well, you don't direct a director. You just don't direct her. And we knew that before we started. Tanith and I knew that that's what we were going to take on. That, she, and I wrote it in the applications for funding that actually she would lead it in a way that only she can lead. Like, and we, and you know, that we'd be in a position to happily sort of follow and go along with it, because I think she was right, actually. I think she made better directorial choices than me, certainly in terms of where the story, you know, should be weighted towards. And I'm very, very glad that my filmmaking instincts told me to just follow that, you know, rather than battle that out with her, or because it's a far more interesting story. It's a far more interesting story.
What did she think of it once she was able to see it?
I think she was very relieved. The words that came out of her mouth were, oh, actually, I don't come off too badly, do I? I don't know what she was thinking I was going to do. I don't know what she thought the film would end up like, you know. But she was genuinely surprised that she didn't look like, I don't know what, like bad. And she was genuinely moved by it. When we had the screening at Sydney Film Festival, which was the second time we'd sort of presented it to the public, she was genuinely moved and was crying, you know, like, and, you know, I think I'm hopeful that she thinks we've given an accurate portrayal and, yeah, haven't sort of sanitized things too much.
There is definitely a particular kind of pressure that comes when you're, A, working with family, but B, like, telling the story of, yeah.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I feel really stupid, but somehow I've managed to get through my filmmaking life and not understand that doing something with your family is, you know, really, 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 really difficult. I don't know how I missed that bit, and was incredibly naive moving into this about, like, just how hard it was going to be. And God knows what planet I was on. Honestly, I have no idea. What an idiot. Anyway, I'm actually really proud of the end result. I feel like we captured her. I feel like we captured her personality, you know, that she's formidable and snappy and also very warm and very caring. I feel really good about getting that right. And I also feel really good about telling the story that she thought was more important, A, because she's right, but B, because that's what she deserves at this stage of her life, you know, like, she deserves to go on that pursuit of the true story of the massacre. And I was really glad that Tanith and I could do it for her.
That was Erica Glynn, director of She Who Must Be Loved, speaking with Away's Rudy Bremer. It's the life story of her mother, Alfreda, better known as Frida Glynn. You can watch the documentary on NITV on Sunday the 14th of July at 8:30 p.m. or catch up on SBS On Demand.